Coming up on Boston Public Radio, the SJC rules that the Suffolk DA cannot prosecute a guy who took upskirt photos of women on the tee. There's universal outrage with the court, but should there be? Then we all know of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X's roles in the struggle for civil rights, but does Stokely Carmichael belong in that pantheon? Tufts Peniel Joseph's book says yes. He'll join us. Then America's most unconventional housing advocate and Boston's own, Bruce Marks, joins us. His goal, helped tens of thousands of lower-income people, those who we think to be too risky to buy their own homes.
Teens turn into human achievement machines as moms and dads spend more and more money to get them into Harvard. Then the Boston Globe's Alex Beam on dramatic changes in SATs and the Pope's latest maneuvers, including a possible nod to gay civil unions. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. I am Marjorie Eakin. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hey, Jim.
You know, before we get to the topic of for the top of the show, there's been a much speculation on the part of politicians and the media about whether or not former Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown will run for the Senate in New Hampshire, but nothing from the former senator himself. Well, WGBH News has learned that Brown disclosed to his family that he is now actively considering a run for New Hampshire's U.S. Senate seat, held, as everybody knows, by incumbent Democrat Jeanne Shaheen. The discussion took place during a recent trip to Taiwan, in which the former Senator Scott Brown met with the president of Taiwan and other dignitaries.
And this comes out, obviously, today, on the same day that a new Boston Herald poll shows that Scott Brown has rather plummeted in the polls up in New Hampshire. He's now trailing Jeanne Shaheen by 52-39. Earlier polls that had the race much closer, and one of them actually even had them tied. And there was speculation that if Brown waited too long to decide whether he was going to run or not, he could be hurt. So I don't know if any effect this latest poll will have on his decision. But we should say also that Scott Brown's wife, Gail Huff, until recently worked at WGBH as a part-time reporter. Terrific reporter, by the way.
She's a great reporter. Just one last thing about this. For those who are saying, oh, he's been considering this, we have not heard anything, even indirectly, from Brown himself. We've speculated, polls have speculated, pundits, I hate that term, pundits have speculated, but this appears to be the first signal from the candidate himself, again to his family, during this recent trip to Taiwan.
And one
Let
last,
the games begin,
well,
as far as I'm concerned.
One last thing we should point out is Jeanne Shaheen has been using Scott Brown as, I don't even want to call him a whipping boy, that's the wrong word.
She's raising money.
She is raising money. Every one of her fundraising or the things that we get on email from Jeanne Shaheen are all about Scott Brown. Scott Brown, Scott Brown, Scott Brown. And, you know, as your friend Arnie Arneson said, it only adds to the zeros in the coffers of Jeanne Shaheen, the incumbent.
So let's get to the topic at hand. So if Massachusetts, Marjorie, is trying to change its reputation of being an uptight and puritanical state, has the state's highest court just fast-tracked us from being puritanical to, I guess you'd say, perverse? Yesterday, the state's Supreme Judicial Court ruled that it is not illegal. Let me repeat it. It is not illegal to secretly photograph underneath a person's clothing. It's a practice known as upskirting, a practice become much more common, obviously, in the era of smartphones. Currently, they say our state law only considers photographing or videotaping people who are nude or partially nude to be illegal. So if you're fully clothed and someone upskirts you, it apparently is a legal undertaking. Now, our number is 877-301-8970. We assume, even though you should feel free to say this, everybody is appalled by the alleged behavior of this man. That's really not the issue today. We want to know if you're equally as appalled as, for example, the Senate president was yesterday with the court's decision. And the reason we ask that question, maybe the court's basically saying the law as it exists in the Commonwealth is behind the technology.
Has to catch up.
Period. So there are those who have been arguing forever that courts should strictly interpret the laws, which they apparently do here, did here. And there are others who say, well, wait a second. They should include in their deliberations the spirit of the law. Bob DeLeo, the House Speaker, says clearly the spirit of the law covered this, but the language of the law did not. Tyler Chase on our Facebook page just wrote, he's obviously in the former camp, it is their job, meaning the courts, to interpret the laws as written. It's in the hands of the legislators to write a proper, up-to-date law. So we want to know, if you are part of what I think is a majority chorus of people who are disgusted with the SJC, or if you are part of that chorus who says it's a disgusting act that they were talking about, but they did the right thing because the legislature has not caught up. And by the way, there was a couple of years ago, Amanda, one of our colleagues, reminded us that in 2010, there was this guy who had been texting or IMing, actually, instant yes. messaging some rather suggestive things
sexually
to
explicit.
Somebody thought was a 13-year-old kid,
exactly.
right? And what happened there?
Well, he was acquitted as well because the state law didn't cover that, and it's in the general laws basically. So what happened is a few weeks later, I think it was two months later, Governor Patrick changed the law, and they came, you know, so now you can no longer do this, and that's a good thing. I imagine this is what's going to happen here. District Attorney Dan Conley has urged Beacon Hill to get with the program here.
Well,
and
they say they're going to
the
do it too.
And they are going to do, well, they let's hope they do it. But what's a little distressing is a couple of things that Michael Robertson, the accused defendant, 32 years of from Andover, he was facing more than 2 years in jail, and he's not going to be going anywhere now.
Well, I think what's far worse is that there can now be, until a law, if it's passed and signed, is passed and signed, apparently if you commit no other crime, you can do this with abandon. You essentially can take your camera and be doing this upskirting thing, wherever that word came from.
There's some hopeful things here, Jim. I think we could agree that most people in the legislature don't think this is a very good idea, and they might move with quick haste to do something here, would you say?
Took them 2 months, years ago, and something equally obvious. I'm not faulting them for that. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's going to be a law tomorrow, Marjorie. Do you? Do you think Deval Patrick's going to sign a new law tomorrow?
I think it's going to be soon.
What do you think about the court's decision, by the way?
Well, I think, unfortunately, the court does have to follow the rules. I don't think you can generally be just going with the spirit of the law kind of thing. You know what is really
weird?
What
do you think Roe v. Wade is, by the way? There's nothing in the Constitution.
That was a way for the Supreme Court to find circuitously and rather Byzantine manner.
A right to privacy, which doesn't even exist in the Constitution.
They wanted to legalize abortion.
So why
and they found a way to do it.
Why couldn't this court have decided this act is so despicable that, to use your language, we'll find a way to do this? By the way, the decision of the court was unanimous. The SJC was unanimous, saying the law does not make this upskirting, as mm-hmm. it's called, an illegal act. Why couldn't they have done the same thing?
I would say that as abhorrent as upskirting, which is such a weird word, is, it doesn't rise to the level of abortion. And it was not a Supreme Court kind of case. So I think much has been written about Roe v. Wade, and the consensus was they were trying to find a way to get this legalized, and they did it in a way which many people, including Ruth Bader Ginsburg, says was a terrible way to do it. They shouldn't have done it a different way. But you know what's interesting in this law in Massachusetts about this upskirting deal is that you can't – if someone is appearing with their body exposed in plain sight, like say someone is just a streaker or they sit on the tee topless and it's a woman, you can't photograph that person. You can't secretly photograph that person. And yet if someone is minding their own business, just wearing a skirt that may be a little bit short, and somebody happens to be out there, some weirdo trying to take a picture, that's okay as the law stands now. It's a very odd situation. Anyway, our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. And the question is basically, should the court here in Massachusetts have done kind of a Supreme Court end run as the Supreme Court did when it legalized abortion and go with the spirit of the law, find a way?
See, let me tell you, I cited the example, but that was a breakthrough and a totally new direction for the court. Do you think there's one sane person who would say that the intention of the legislature was anything other than to make something like this illegal, but they just didn't update the law through their Emerging Technologies Committee or whatever the name of the committee is, which, by the way, should be examining all laws immediately to make sure that they are up to date vis-a-vis current technology? It clearly was the intention of lawmakers originally to ensure that behavior like this was illegal. And that's why I think, and again, I have respect for this court, that's why I think this court could have found a way without contorting itself.
Again, you know, this is a really creepy kind of thing that's going on around here. I had no idea it was going on as frequently as it is. There's a story about an Apple store with a glass staircase where apparently people are doing this upskirting thing all the time, and it had been going on the tee. It's terrible. But I am one that is a little bit hesitant about the courts going too wild beyond the law. And this is not a coast-to-coast emergency situation.
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. If anybody's had – we don't want to go too far here, but if anybody's had experience with this or has witnessed this sort of behavior. I am betting it is not as uncommon. I don't think it's every time you get on the green line that you're facing this kind of thing. But there's a lot of perversion around. And it's,
yeah, there
this
is. Is.
By the way, and this is scary. You know, if you go online, and I'm not going to share them with you. I mean, a lot of people made a lot of jokes about this. It's very easy to make cheap jokes. But it really is a serious behavior. I mean, beyond the fact that it's, in my opinion, a grotesque invasion of privacy, it's sort of like a sexual assault. If someone put their hand up your dress, I assume there's no question that's an assault. It's
that
a sexual
assault.
Well, to me, taking a picture is pretty close. It is pretty close, and close enough that I believe the court could have, again, ruled
well,
on what they
again,
believe was the spirit of the existing
here's
law.
Again what they said, and I'm reading from Laurel Sweet's piece this morning in the Boston Herald, that a female passenger on an MBTA trolley who is wearing a skirt, dress, or the like covering these private parts of her body is not a person who is partially nude, no matter what is or what is not underneath the skirt by way of underwear or other clothing. So you're right. I mean, I don't think that probably the court feels great about this.
Oh, I'm
they
sure
seem
they
to be saying, go ahead, upskirt to beat the band. But on the other hand, the law was written in a way that needs to be amended, and I would hope that our legislature gets right to amending it.
You know what's, one last thing before we give the number. You know what I also learned in the Globe story, maybe in the Herald story too, when originally this Robertson character was charged with a crime in Boston Municipal Court four years ago. Do you know what the crime was? Criminal voyeurism. Do you know what that is? A misdemeanor. I mean, it's sort of like we learned that Carlos Enriquez, wasn't he charged with convicted of misdemeanors, the state rep who ended up going to jail for 6 months?
I'm
90% sure.
Not felonies.
The assault. I mean, how can criminal voyeurism be a misdemeanor? I mean, it's just.
You know, it always it brings up the age-old question, Jim, that I ask on these occasions.
Which is?
What is wrong with men? You know, I mean, women aren't running around doing these weird things. When was the last time you heard of a peeping woman? They're always peeping toms, aren't they? I mean, when was the last time you heard about some girl with a cell phone running around trying to get shots at the boys' locker room at the gym? I think that there's a problem here. Then someone should investigate it big time. 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970.
Let's go to Chris.
Alan just emailed and said he wants to know if you should tell his three young girls that they're asking for it if they wear skirts in public. This ruling is absurd, and the SJC needs to use common sense.
By the way, they're not asking for it, but it is perfectly legal if you're, what do you say, his daughters?
Yes.
If his three young daughters go out and another Robertson character chooses to try to take a photograph and doesn't violate any other laws, then he's A-OK.
Let's go to John in the car. What do you think, John?
Hey, John.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Excellent.
Fine,
thanks.
But, Jim, isn't it kind of a double standard? I mean, you're against this, but why is it all right for the gays to dance half-naked on a parade? Doesn't that?
What law are they? First of all, what gays are dancing half-naked on a parade? I have seen more heterosexuals dropping trow after getting drunk at a bar than I have gays ever dancing around. So what's it got to do with this, John?
It's a double standard, Jim. That's all I'm saying.
Wait,
have a good day.
How is it? I'm having a wonderful day, but how is it a double standard, John? You brought it up, not me.
Well, he's certainly not talking about the St. Patrick's Day parade.
We didn't hang up on John, by the way, just so you know.
I think he may be talking about people in various states of undress at the gay pride parade, but that's a whole different experience.
It is a whole different experience. Let's go out to Amherst, where Chris is on Boston Public Radio. Thank you kindly for the call, Chris.
Chris in Danvers, maybe.
I'm sorry.
Hi,
well, that's
Chris.
Close enough for us. Hi, Chris in Danvers.
That's okay. You made my day last time I called. You told me that I made a great point in being married 26 years. I don't hear that a lot, so I'm hoping I can be two for two here.
See if we can help you out in a few minutes, Chris. Go ahead.
All right. So what I don't understand is if I went on the tee with my cell phone camera and started pointing the camera in people's faces and started taking pictures of that, I don't think that would be allowed either. I mean, wouldn't that be a violation to do that?
No, that's not a great point. You don't get a star for this one, Chris. Even though emotionally I am totally with you, it does feel like an invasion. I think the expression that would apply is there's no expectation of privacy. Meaning,
in public.
I think there is, exactly, when you're in public and on a tee, I think there is an expectation of privacy that someone is not pointing a camera at your crotch. But, as this Robertson character did, but there's no expectation, as unfair as it seems, that if you're on a tee, you're walking through the common or something, that if someone snaps a photo of you, even though you'd say, well, you should have asked me first, I think that it feels wrong, but it legally isn't, Chris.
I'm surprised you're not using this moment to go on about the cameras that are everywhere taking pictures of us all, whether we want to have those pictures taken or not.
I'm not a big surveillance camera guy. Chris, thank you for the call anyway. The next one I know will get you your second star. It's just the problem with it is really perverse. And it is true that people, and I probably am guilty of this too, when you like a decision, then you say the way the court interpreted the law is excellent. When you don't like a decision, you either say, well, they should have been more activist, so they should have been less activist. I'd like to think I'm consistent, but I admit sometimes
I have to tell my favorite story in this regard. There was a priest, he's dead now, John Gagan, he was killed in prison, actually, who allegedly had molested dozens and dozens and dozens of young boys, but he – maybe girls too, I'm not sure. But in any case, because of the statute of limitations, because no one had ever come forward in time, he got away with all those things. But he was caught for grabbing the thigh of a kid that was in a swimming pool.
Yep.
So as the kid goes to climb out of the pool, Gagan grabs his thigh. Mm-hmm. He gets tried for this case, which is – grabbing the thigh, a simple assault, you would say. Maybe you could say an assault with an intent to be indecent toward a kid under 14. Well, in any case, this was not a big sentence kind of crime, and the judge gave him 10 years.
Was that Constance Sweeney? Who was the judge in that case?
I forget.
Well, can I tell you, you know what's analogous? You know what's even higher profile?
I must admit, I was very happy that she gave him 10 years.
Do you think O.J. would have done 40 years in jail for armed burglary or whatever it was? He was sentenced essentially for killing his wife and Ron Goldman.
That's right.
I mean, so judges will always deny you can't do that. You can't set an example.
Well, juries do it too.
Gagan's a perfect. I totally
agree.
Juries
do it too. But I don't know. In this case, this is the Massachusetts
By the way, you don't think Carlos Enriquez did that too? Is it essentially, if you can't sentence someone based upon the fact that the crime that he was found guilty of was committed by a public official. The public official you don't
the
think
issue
that the
different
judge in that case
in Enriquez.
No, but you don't think the judge in that case was considering the fact that he was a public official as opposed to just an average Joe on the street?
I think that was part of it, but I think the bigger part, and she was right, he never admitted he did anything wrong.
No,
the jury
agreed.
Found him guilty.
But that's relevant. What legally is not relevant, even though I'm sure it's considered, was the point I was trying to make, is that he's a public official. That shouldn't be a part of the consideration from what I understand, but I'm betting in
those
cases it is.
I don't know, because I'm not sure how many people that are caught in battering situations insist that they're innocent, that they never did anything wrong and force the state to go to trial. When you force the state to go to trial and you're guilty, the state does not react well to your forcing that situation. Anyway, Laura in Rainham. What do you think, Laura?
Hey, Laura.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just trying to get ready to go to the dentist, but I was listening to both of you, and all I could think of is years ago going through the funhouse and having a dress on and getting to that. You all remember there was a certain spot where you came out in the open upstairs, and this big shot of air.
Sure.
Remember, blew your dress up, and all I could remember is, oh my goodness, how many people had been waiting for me to come out to see, you know? Or how about that guy who ran the whole fun house? Did he have a camera set up waiting for and did I have my good underwear on that day?
Oh, Laura. Oh, you're right. The
not
creepy
really.
Guys at the carnivals. Oh, God.
Oh, isn't that something? And you have, and then Filene's basement. I remember being down there in the early 70s when I was going to school and trying on shoes, and there was no room, and there was this heavy set woman. She was saying, oh, my God, you have to be an acrobat to really try on anything down here. And I remember this fellow came by and just dropped the camera in this compromising position she was in and snapped, and he disappeared. And I went, and then he was gone, and nobody knew the better of the situation, and I happened to see that. But it always stuck with me.
Apparently it did. Laura, those are two great stories.
They are great.
Thank you.
Well, remember the stories about the cameras in the dressing rooms?
Oh, of course.
You've heard those. I remember there was a hairdresser down the Cape when I was little. He had a camera in the bathroom of his hairdressing salon.
So let me ask you a question. I know you're not a lawyer, and I'm sort of a former
lawyer.
If you put a secret camera in a locker room, but it only took pictures of men or women in their underwear, that wouldn't be a violation of law under this decision?
Again, that
if they're
is
never
how,
nude or partially nude while you're taking the photograph?
Well, I guess the question is, what's the definition of partially nude? I think their definition is that you have to have a private part fully exposed. So I guess if you're in your underpants and your bra, then you are not partially nude. You're sort of in a bikini type thing or something.
Well, I hope the legislature deals with this. Claire from Foxborough will try to squeeze you in. Hi, Claire.
Hi. I just wanted to call and talk about the fact that none of this perversion is new, as Laura was saying. I'm in 1962, I was a senior in high school. I worked at the local public library as a student at local Catholic high school. I had my uniform on. I'd go to work. I had to work in the back of the stacks putting books away according to the Dewey Decimal System. And in the stacks, you've got the glass floors that are they're milky glass floors, but they're not attached to the stacks. So there's a 3-inch gap going all the way up to the top of the library, several stories. And often you would look down when you're putting books away, and there was a guy under there looking up your skirt. And so you'd go and get the library cop. The cop would toss the guy out, and 2 days later he'd be back again doing the same thing.
So Michael Robertson is continuing a great tradition of perversion. Claire, thanks for the call. The only thing I don't understand, and I used to lobby on Beacon Hill, is while it's great that they acted fairly expeditiously after this texting thing or IMing thing in 2010, why can't both houses, since no one's going to object to this in the opposition party, why can't they pass it in the House today?
That'd
pass
be a great
it in
idea.
The Senate tonight.
That'd be a great
and
idea.
And Deval Patrick sign it before he goes to bed. I just don't. I'm sure there's a reason, but maybe we should check.
Well, you know what the good thing is, though, Jim? It's What's so that? Cold out that we have a few days probably before anybody's going to be out there and wearing short skirts. So no one can, they'll freeze to death if they're running around in those now. Okay. Up next, we are going to talk with Peniel Joseph from Tufts University. He's going to talk about his fantastic new biography of Stokely Carmichael. Where would the civil rights movement be today without Carmichael's leadership? That conversation next, 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
As they look for the best job applicants they can get, bankers are trading in their suits for jeans.
The market that we're in is really competing for programmers, which is a very, very competitive market.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, old school bankers versus new school technology in the world of high frequency trading. That's next time on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6 here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Lesley University, where creativity empowers educators, artists, and counselors to turn their passions into their futures. Lesley University, what will you make happen? More information available at lesleyuniversity.edu. And the This Old House Hour, General Contractor Tom Silva and his crew continue renovations on the 1872 Italianate home in Arlington. Don't miss the This Old House Hour, tonight at 8 on WGBX 44.
I'm Dana from Sharon, Massachusetts, and I support WGBH because Boston Public Radio gives me information that really deepens my understanding of the world. It's intelligent and it's thoughtful and analytical with just the right dose of humor, and because it's the home of Jim and Marjorie.
You're listening to a third hour of a special edition of Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan.
Well, I've been listening to them for a couple of years now, and when they moved to WGBH, I was just thrilled because I've always thought that their brand of news analysis were more appropriate for public radio. They really pulled me over to become a supporter. I was one of those people who would flip to GBH occasionally in the car, but now I actually have it on a dedicated button on my radio. I've always believed in putting my money where my mouth is, and I've always tried to be a supporter of the things that I believe in. So now it's Boston Public Radio.
Well, that made our day, I should say. call 888-897-9424, please, or pitch in online at WGBHnews.org. You're listening to WGBH, as you know, is at a very important time for us. It's our March community campaign, and this campaign is almost over now. Joining us in the studio, Marjorie and me in studio to talk about all this is Kim Soulmarsh. Hey, Kim.
Hey, Jim. So I'm so excited to be here. I have to tell you, we are on a mission to say thanks to 75 folks today. So that's you, 74 others doing your part. And boy, do I have a great incentive for you. Judy Collins is back, my friends. She's back. I have to tell you, you know, we had these Judy Collins tickets. It was sold out, and Judy, being the lovely person that she is, said, you know what? Let's add another show exclusively for WGBH supporters.
Great.
This is the only place that you're going to get these tickets. It's so exciting. It's one of your very last chances to get these tickets. So we have 50 pairs. That's it. These are going to go flying, I have to tell you. It's happening Sunday, September 21st at the Wilbur Theater. That's going to be the 3 p.m. show. So I don't want you to miss out. One of your very last chances to snag Judy Collins. Keep in mind, you can't get these anywhere else. So let's hear from you right now. Snag yours by calling 888-897-9424. It's a phones-only offer. Again, that's 888-897-WGBH.
So here's the mission of our March Community Campaign, to say thanks to as many people as possible. And here are some of the reasons why you come to 89.7. Unique stories, objective journalism, quality programs. The thing is, though, none of that would happen without your support. So I hope you'll join this thank you mission by supporting 89.7 right now, because I would really love to say thanks to you today.
By the way, if you want to see a great photograph of Judy Collins with two of my favorite people, that'd be Marjorie and me in today's Boston Globe name section, you should do it. So if you're hungry for an incentive to do some good, how about a year's worth of goodies from America's Test Kitchen? You keep New England's plate full of the good stuff by supporting WGBH, and America's Test Kitchen will say thanks with, listen to these things, annual subscriptions to their magazines, Cook's Illustrated and Cook's Country, plus a copy of their latest cookbook. It's called Cooking School, signed by the entire cast, by the way, and two VIP invitations to their Test Kitchen in Brookline for a special taping of the show. What a mouthful. The number is 888-897-9424. I didn't know till Kim said it a minute ago that 9424 is actually 897-WGBH. Or get in on this contest by doing your part online at WGBHnews.org.
What a day to give, right? So this campaign is wrapping up very, very quickly. So you've got the contest that you're automatically going to be entered in into America's Test Kitchen that Jim just told you about. But we have those Judy Collins tickets back, 50 pairs back for another show. I don't want you to miss these, because we will run out of these. It's a gift of $150 right now. We're going to say thanks with that pair of tickets to see Judy Collins. This is the only place you can get this, folks. This is it. So I hope you don't miss it. It's Sunday, September 21st. It's a 3 p.m. show. Get in on those. 888-897-9424. 888-897-WGBH. Already now down to 72 folks needing to hear. So this
great.
Is going to go pretty quick.
So please help however you can today and take advantage of the special offers on the table. Judy Collins sang for us in studio yesterday, and I was stunned. Her voice sounds as great now as it did back in the 1970s. It's amazing. So we are on this thank you mission, and we want to say thanks to you, and I hope you will do your part. The campaign's almost over, so call 888-897-9424 or get involved online at WGBHnews.org.
Hi, it's Christopher Kimball from America's Test Kitchen. Lots of cultures have their very own way of giving thanks for food, rituals and words that mean something very special. And hearing my compliments to the chef always warmed my heart. Well, 89.7 is on a mission to say thank you to 3,000 WGBH supporters. And when you add your name to that list by making a gift in any amount, you'll be automatically entered to win two tickets to a taping of America's Test Kitchen TV show at our Test Kitchen in Brookline. Also a copy of our Cooking School cookbook signed by the entire cast, and subscriptions to both of our magazines, Cook's Illustrated as well as Cook's Country. To do your part and be entered into the contest, call 888-897-9424 or go to our website, WGBHnews.org. Thanks and good luck.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Stokely Carmichael was a controversial figure in the fight for the rights of blacks in this country. He was leader in both SNCC, formerly known as the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and the much more militant group, the Black Panthers. He also gave us a new way of thinking about civil rights and talking about it by popularizing the phrases like black power and institutional racism. Here's Stokely Carmichael spelling out the differences between Martin Luther King Jr. and himself.
his major assumption was that if you suffer, your opponent will see your suffering and will be moved to change his heart. He only made one fallacious assumption. In order for nonviolence to work, your opponent must have a conscience. The United States has none.
Carmichael's influence on Black America then and today is the subject of a new biography entitled Stokely, A Life. Here with us in Studio 3 is the man behind the book, Peniel Joseph. As you know, Peniel's a professor of history and founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts University. Peniel, congratulations. Good to see you again.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So we can sense just by that one little clip how he might have annoyed certain people. But why was Stokely Carmichael such a big deal and so significant in the civil rights movement?
Well, I mean, once he unleashes that phrase, Black Power, in Greenwood, Mississippi, June 16th, 1966, there's a three-week-long Meredith March against fear. James Meredith had been the first Black student to enroll at Ole Miss.
Yep.
There was rioting in 1962 that left a person dead because of that in Oxford, Mississippi. He stages a one-man march in Mississippi. He's shot down on his second day. He's injured in the hospital, and Stokely, Martin Luther King Jr., all the civil rights leaders go down to continue his march to Jackson, Mississippi, the capital. So it's a 220-mile, three-week-long march. And on that march, Stokely and SNCC, they're trying to organize sharecroppers for voting rights. And they unleashed that term. It was planned to, instead of freedom now, Black Power. And so Black Power turned Stokely, who's a very well-known organizer. Dr. King knows who he is. He's a graduate of Howard University. Movement people knew who he was. He was a day-to-day organizer. Bob Moses, who's still around in Cambridge. You know, Bob was one of Stokely's heroes.
I interviewed Moses a couple of weeks ago with his great algebra project.
One of the real heroes of the movement. So Stokely was somebody people knew, but he gains a national stage that evening. And Black Power really scandalizes the movement, right? That term is going to be taken by whites to be a declaration of war.
Threatening.
Very threatening. Stokely's going to argue that it's about self-determination, political, social, cultural. And he initially argues that Black Power is what's needed to have radical democracy in the United States. Over time, that call is a call for political revolution, anti-imperialism, anti-capitalism. And one of the things I argue in this book is he's really America's biggest anti-war activist before Dr. King, before Muhammad Ali come out against the war.
Didn't he convince King that, didn't he push him in the direction of opposing the Vietnam War?
Well, the other phrase, too, I had no idea was associated with Carmichael. Hell no, we won't go.
Hell no, we won't go.
Yeah, I didn't even know that till I saw it in your book.
He popularizes that term to both white and Black audiences. So what's interesting about Stokely is that he becomes one of the most, if not the most sought after campus speaker in 1966, 67, 68. And he speaks at not just historically Black colleges and universities, large white audiences. So he's at Berkeley speaking against the Vietnam War, but also talking about white privilege, saying the reason we don't have genuine democracy in the United States is not because of Black people, but because of this idea of white privilege and institutional racism.
So before we get back to him and what he did and why he matters so much and why he's been practically airbrushed out of history, I think, until you and several other scholars like you. Yesterday, Judy Collins was sitting where you're sitting, and I said, let's go back to little Judy Collins. Let's go back to little Peniel Joseph, when all of a sudden you heard of Stokely Carmichael for the first time. When was it? What was your reaction? What was it like, Peniel?
Well, I grew up in a political household. I'm the proud son of Haitian immigrants who came to the United States in 1965. I grew up in New York City. I was in junior high school watching the television series Eyes on the Prize. Mm-hmm. And that's got real local connections with Henry Hampton. Callie Crossley worked on
indeed.
That. Judy Richardson, different activists worked on that and journalists. And Eyes on the Prize, he's there. He's 24 years old. He's not yet 25 when he makes that call for Black Power. And I found him mesmerizing because I knew who Malcolm X was. Mm-hmm. I'd seen footage of Dr. King. He was much younger. He was super, super eloquent, really, really handsome, very, very charismatic, and I wanted to know more.
And I'm assuming that once you got in the academic business, it's been in the back of your head, if not the front of your head, all along, that you were going to do this.
Yeah,
is that a safe assumption?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, speaking of little Peniel, let's talk about little Stokely, because I did not know he came from Trinidad. Tell us how he went from basically being left by his parents in Trinidad with his family to being a superstar so young.
He's really, really brilliant. Born June 29th, 1941 in Port of Spain, Trinidad. That was one of the colonies of the sprawling British Empire. So he's born before independence, but it still shapes him very, very importantly. He remembers being in line for Flag Day when Princess Anne comes. But there's all these black leaders there, too. So he's born in a black world. By the time he comes to the United States, 2 weeks before his 11th birthday, United States, New York City is something different. But he moves to a predominantly white section of the Bronx, Morris Park. They're the only African-American family there. He tests into Bronx science. He's one of eight African-Americans out of a class of 300, including people like Jeff Greenfield, the journalist.
Is that so?
Yeah, class of 1960. He's, when you talk to people at Bronx Science, he's one of the most popular, if not the most popular student at Bronx Science.
So why was that?
Hugely charismatic, on the soccer team, could talk and befriend everyone, visited both family in Harlem, but also befriended Eugene Dennis Jr., whose father was a big Communist Party official. So Stokely is friends with some of New York's leading, the children of New York's leading left and liberal, and including there's a big Jewish-American connection here, too, because Bronx Science was predominantly Jewish. And so what's interesting about Stokely is that he's reading Marxism, he's reading socialism, but he's also reading about the black tradition. Bayard Rustin, the openly gay black social democrat, is one of his mentors in the 1950s. So he's politicized as a teenager. He's organizing garment workers. He's actually marching in pro-Israel marches as well, which is ironic because by the late 60s, he's this huge, you know, advocate for Palestinian liberation. So he comes to politics even before the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, even before the sit-in movement. So the sit-in movement further politicizes him at Howard University. He's going to organize in Mississippi, meet up with Bob Moses. He's arrested for the first time at 19 in 1961, spends 40 days in Mississippi's worst prison farm. There's a great book by David Oshinsky called Worse Than Slavery. And David Oshinsky is the Pulitzer Prize winning historian at University of Texas. And what's interesting about Stokely is that he meets John Lewis, too. Congressman John Lewis,
and
they bond in jail together. You know, John Lewis says he liked Stokely Carmichael instantly on the spot. So Bob Moses, Ella Baker, the founder of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Fannie Lou Hamer, all these people influence him. One of his deepest friendships is with Martin Luther King Jr.
Well, you know, that's what's most interesting. I've talked ad nauseum about my love of the play about LBJ at the ART. And there's a great scene
that.
About, you know, and this is the Breaking Bad guy, Bryan Cranston, yes. Plays LBJ. And there's a great scene where the split in the civil rights movement amongst black leaders. And when you read what you've written, which I was unaware of, despite the fact that Carmichael took a much more confrontational approach to the fight for civil rights than Dr. King did, they remained friendly through. How did that work? I mean, most of us who don't know what you know assume when there are political splits, it leads to very bad endings of relationships. Why were they able to maintain a warm one or a friendly one at least?
They're both very, very charismatic individuals, but they're both individuals who don't hold grudges. What's interesting about them, sometimes people will say they're born politicians, but it's more than that. They actually love people. So they could separate the personal from the political. And also Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, diffuses tension through humor. So he's always cracking jokes. And that's something that the public doesn't see in terms of the black power rock star image with the dark glasses, the great suits on. But he's somebody who's diffusing jokes. He's a chameleon in the sense that he does impressions of Dr. King and anybody else,
oh,
LBJ.
Man. Is anything any of that on tape?
I don't know if any of it is
that be seeing Carmichael do an imitation of King.
Yeah, of King, of LBJ. He does it all.
Oh,
so
my
so
God.
That's
we
part of the
YouTube
reason.
Back then to capture all that kind of stuff, right? We're talking to Tufts University's Peniel Joseph, who's written a new biography of Stokely Carmichael. So he's a big star, totally charismatic and charming, but he starts getting harassed by the FBI and the United States government, and which many people think, you included, think that that ultimately why he left the United States to go to Africa. But tell us what happened to him as he was fighting for civil rights.
Well, the anti-war activism, the anti-imperial activism, really the black radicalism, hell no, we won't go. He publicly criticizes Lyndon Johnson ad nauseum, speeches from California to New York, but also the trips overseas. He goes to Cuba. Without permission.
Yeah.
He goes to, you know, London, Cuba, Paris, Algiers, Africa, China and Vietnam. All this makes him sort of public enemy number one. Lyndon Johnson requests twice weekly reports on Stokely. The FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, is very, very interested in every single thing that he's doing. They try to get charges of sedition and treason on him. And we've got these documents, tons of documents, through the Freedom of Information Act. They initially don't know after the Black Power speech whether he's a citizen or not, and they're trying to deport him from the United States. They find out that he has citizenship through derivation from his father in 1953, so they can't do that.
And
so,
by the way, let me interrupt you just to say, you are the person who got first access to thousands of these documents, and that's part of what forms the basis for your book,
yes,
correct?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry, I interrupt you mid-thought, but you deserve
praise.
So
he's getting harassed by J. Edgar Hoover.
J. Edgar Hoover, the State Department, he's really messing up aspects of American foreign policy because he's with Fidel Castro in July and August of 1967 when Newark and Detroit have exploded. He's with Fidel Castro in the Sierra Maestra Mountains, but also in Santiago de Cuba. And there's a million people there, and Fidel is saying this is the number one leader of the Black Revolutionary. And also Fidel says if anybody injures him, there's going to be consequences to pay. I mean, so it's an extraordinary sort of heady time where you can hang out with Fidel Castro. He's hanging out with Allen Ginsberg, Tom
Great
Hayden,
poet.
Kwame Nkrumah.
Jane Fonda's ex-wife. Ex-husband, I should say.
Ex-husband. all these people, all these huge luminaries. Martin Luther King Jr. is a personal friend. So he does become hunted. He does become harassed. And he eventually moves to West Africa, Conakry, Guinea. And he's under the really the protection of Sekou Touré, the leader and president of Guinea, and the ousted president of Ghana, Kwame Nkrumah, and becomes convinced that revolutionary Pan-Africanism, transforming Africa, you know, one army, one leader, one country, will be the vehicle for Black liberation in the United States.
Well, the big question that was raised in that spectacular New York Times long article about your book, I thought was a fascinating one. What impact on civil rights and the whole Black Power movement did his leaving to go to Africa have? I mean, how might things have been different here had he stayed?
Well, I think certainly it leaves a vacuum, and other leaders try to fill in that vacuum, people like Amiri Baraka, other Black activists who are interested in Pan-Africanism. But certainly there's a vacuum. He continues to come back and tour in the United States. But his politics in terms of the All African People's Revolutionary Party, Nkrumahism, Touréism, where he's saying he's got specific answers to all these global questions of capitalistic inequality, racial oppression, it's going to attract less attention. It's going to attract less believers. Black Power was broad enough and universal enough. The argument he makes with Bayard Rustin, who had been his former mentor and who had debated Malcolm X at Howard University in 1961, he has a debate with Bayard Rustin in 1966, and it's sort of coming full circle where this was the man he had wanted to be. Bayard Rustin was his hero, and now Bayard Rustin was a huge critic of Black Power. And Rustin tells him Black Power is too narrow. You need white allies. You need labor allies. And Stokely makes the argument that Black Power is universal, but it's universal human rights in Black. And that something that's Black can also be universal. Very, very interesting argument.
So, Peniel Joseph, I assume if you were teaching a class and a student said, so name the three leaders of the civil rights movement in this country who we have to focus on laser-like, you'd say King, Malcolm X, and Stokely Carmichael. Or at least he'd be in that pantheon.
Oh, absolutely.
Why is he not with most people who are not Peniel Joseph? Is it because he left for, what, the last 30 years of his life for Africa? Is it because he wasn't martyred by being assassinated?
Yeah.
I mean, why is he one layer down in the minds of most people who look back at that period of our history?
Well, I think it's three reasons. Certainly, he left at a very young age. So by 1969, he's away from the scene.
How old was he then?
Oh, boy, he leaves when he's 27 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, he's 27. And he dies at 57.
Yeah, what happened to him?
Well,
how did he die?
He dies of prostate cancer, November 15th, 1998. And in American imagination, what's interesting is once you leave the United States, that's it, right? People are saying you might as well be dead because you're no longer on the cover of magazines.
Understood.
And you're not doing great shows like this. But in the 1960s, he was writing for the New Republic. He was covered in the New York Times. He wrote for the New York Review of Books, long essay, September 22nd, 1966.
Well, he was a genius. I mean, a child prodigy.
Absolutely
in terms
brilliant.
Of his intellectual
Absolutely
ability.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And a real intellectual. So he leaves and continues to organize away from the bright light. So he never thinks that he's not living a well-lived life.
Yeah.
But he understands that he's lost the same kind of celebrity, not his own political integrity or personal sincerity, but the celebrity of the late 60s. He never tries to recapture, nor does he ever recapture it, right? So what's interesting about him is that he fades into obscurity for the mainstream, but not for people who are Pan-Africanists, not for people who are diehard grassroots activists. They know who Stokely Carmichael Kwame Ture is.
Well, let's stay with the mainstream for a second. So reason number one of your list of three as to why he's been second-tiered, and you may change that with your books, Stokely A Life by Peniel Joseph. What's reason one is he left the country, so out of sight, out of mind is generally our approach. What are reasons two and three?
Well, two is that he was not martyred. If he was martyred the way in which Malcolm and Martin, both Malcolm, 39 years old.
February 21st,
1965, and then King, April 4th, 1968. Both of those men never lived to the age of 40. Mm. So they are left perpetually frozen in time in youth, right? Because they didn't get old, literally, right? So if Carmichael had been assassinated in the late 60s, he would have been this huge iconic figure. Yeah. We would have known him as this black power icon who was fell down by, you know,
gave his
life for the movement. And I think the final reason is that it's very tough to rehabilitate Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, and the radical revolutionary critique that he possesses. Because what we do is we don't talk about his civil rights activism. Because before he's a black power activist, he's a day-to-day civil rights organizer. And what I mean by that, he's sleeping on the floors of shotgun shacks in Alabama. He's sleeping on the floors of people's homes in rural Mississippi, the Delta, right? And he's recruiting both black and white students to organize. So he is an interracial organizer. He is one of the people who, when you interview white activists who worked with him, they said, I would have followed Stokely anywhere. And he was this man of enormous integrity and presence, right? So no one wants to talk about that side, the person who, even though he doesn't go to the March on Washington, he recruits people from Mississippi to go to the March on Washington. He testifies before a U.S. Civil Rights Commission at Howard University in D.C. In 1963 when they're not allowing any integration in a building, a new gymnasium that they're building.
How many years do you work on this?
10 years.
And do you feel like you know him? I mean, I don't mean like you know him, like you know about him, but do you feel like you know Stokely Carmichael?
Oh, yeah. No, I do feel I know him. I don't think any book can do proper justice to gigantic, iconic figures.
That.
But certainly, no, I do feel I know him. And I think he's somebody who's enormously important for both this idea of citizenship and democracy, but also important in terms of race relations, because we need people who are going to push the envelope. I mean, his big idea was this notion of equality. You know, we talk about social entrepreneurship and TED Talks in 10 minutes. Give me a big idea. That's what his big idea was.
Do you think he'd march in the South Boston St. Patrick's Day Parade on that week on Sunday? Probably not, right?
Well, I mean, if there were working class people there and people who were for racial and economic justice, he actually would. Yeah.
If they are, they're keeping a low profile. There's no banner saying they're for it. Let's put it that way. Hey, Peniel, congratulations again. You did
book,
a phenomenal job, and I'm embarrassed how much I've forgotten until I saw your book, A Biography of Stokely, A Life. You can catch Peniel Joseph at the Harvard Bookstore tonight at 7 o'clock.
Peniel's
professor of history and founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts University. Thanks again for coming in, Peniel.
Hey, thanks to you both for having me.
Great to see
Up
you.
Next, we're going to talk about strange bedfellows, how the nonprofit Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America and Bank of America are working together to give folks affordable loans at an affordable interest rate. That conversation next, 89.7 WGBH.
This is Greg Wong.
Stay up to date with the latest in high-tech news, personalities, companies, and trends with the Xconomy Report, presented in partnership with Xconomy.com. Friday mornings at 7:50 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Ever thought of Jane Austen as innovative?
It's so pioneering to write about women who struggle with money, who struggle with class.
Pioneering Women on Innovation Hub tonight at 9 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Fuller Craft Museum. You can join them Sunday, March 9th at 2 p.m. for a reception celebrating The Stories We Tell, works by Tommy Simpson, Michelle Holzapfel, and Bin Pho. Details online at fullercraft.org. And Mass Eye and Ear. Sense life, experience life. When ear, nose, and throat problems affect the way you experience life, experience the difference Mass Eye and Ear can make. Visit masseyeandear.org for more information.
Hi, it's Christopher Kimball from America's Test Kitchen. Lots of cultures have their very own way of giving thanks for food, rituals and words that mean something very special. And hearing my compliments to the chef always warmed my heart. Well, 89.7 is on a mission to say thank you to 3,000 WGBH supporters. And when you add your name to that list by making a gift in any amount, you'll be automatically entered to win two tickets to a taping of America's Test Kitchen TV show at our Test Kitchen in Brookline. Also a copy of our Cooking School cookbook signed by the entire cast, and subscriptions to both of our magazines, Cooks Illustrated as well as Cooks Country. To do your part and be entered into the contest, call 888-897-9424 or go to our website, wgbhnews.org. Thanks and good luck.
And if you forgot what was said to you 2 seconds ago, let me say it again. Online at wgbhnews.org. You can call that phone number, 888-897-9424. And 9424, I just learned, is the same as WGBH. Good afternoon to all of you. I'm Jim Browdy. Marjorie Egan's here, too. We're really glad you're here because we're getting very close to the end of our March community campaign. And joining the two of us in studio to give you a few more details is Kim Saltmarsh, our colleague. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Jim. So I told you that we have Judy Collins tickets. They're back. And I told you that they were going to go fast. We're already down to 38 pairs left.
Wow.
These are going to go, I would say, before 2 o'clock. So you have an hour, five minutes, maybe, to take advantage of the new Judy Collins tickets. Let me tell you about it. When you support great music with a gift of $150 right now, we're going to say thank you with a pair of those tickets. I have to tell you, only now 38 pairs left. Judy was so lovely. She was on WGBH television last night, if you caught her. And because we sold out that first show, she said, you know what? I would love to have another show for WGBH supporters. So this is your very, very last chance to get on to the Judy Collins concert. Again, 38 pairs left. I have to tell you, they will go fast. And again, she was on WGBH television last night. Let's give a little listen.
Some have changed, some forever.
So I am in full swoon. That is All My Life by Judy Collins. I almost can't speak.
First of all, we have to say thank you for calling and giving your donation.
I know. Well, say it. Go ahead.
I love you, a bushel and a peck, a bushel and a peck, and a hug around the neck, hug around the neck, and a barrel and a heap, a barrel and a heap, and I'm talking about you in my sleep, or however it goes.
And she was also on Boston Public Radio. She was with you guys yesterday. She is so lovely, and she still looks fantastic, by the way. So get in on this concert. Again, it will sell out Sunday, September 21st at the Wilbur Theater. That's the 3 p.m. show. I don't want you to miss it because they will go fast. So you got to call for it, 888-897-9424. That's 888-897-WGBH, as Jim just learned.
And we want to say thank you, thank you, thank you to these people who just gave: Cheryl in Dedham, Darcy in Holden, Carl in Arlington, Andrew and Tristan in Newton Highlands, Robert in Cumberland, Rhode Island, Maureen in Brookline, and Susan in Hopedale. Thank you very much. And don't miss out on those Judy Collins tickets that Kim just talked about. You'll be automatically entered into that America's Test Kitchen contest as well. Okay? Campaign's almost over. Call 888-897-9424, 888-897-9424, or give online at wgbhnews.org. Here's the most important part of the 89.7 March Community Campaign, this thank you idea. That's why the goal of this very short campaign is to send out 3,000 thank yous before it's all said and done. But with just a couple of days to go, we need to hear from 1,200 of you. And I hope your name will be next on a thank you list. We have people standing by to say thank you when you call 888-897-9424 or keep a lookout for our thank you note after you give online at wgbhnews.org.
You know, here on 89.7 WGBH, you also hear stories you will not find anywhere else. WGBH's priority is to be the local voice. That's why just this week you learned about Boston's new special court system for military veterans. You may have also caught some exclusive coverage about the governor's race. If this is why you turn to 89.7, it's one of the reasons I do, we hope you'll turn your listening into a show of support right now.
I sure hope you will, too. Again, 888-897-9424. You can also do your part online at wgbhnews.org. You know, I realize fundraising probably isn't your favorite part of public broadcasting. You come here for Jim and Marjorie, and I don't blame you. But here's how it works. Public broadcasting relies on you. So that's why every once in a while, we have fundraisers like this one. And today, we're having having a lot of fun with the Judy Collins tickets. So support with a gift of $150 right now. We would love to say thank you with a pair of tickets to see Judy Collins. They sold out last time. Yesterday they were gone. And Judy brought back another show. But you can only get these tickets here. We have now 37 pairs left, I have to tell you, because of Gary in Hampton, New Hampshire. So Gary, thank you so much for doing your part. I hope you're next. I hope you get in on the Judy tickets before we run out. 888-897-9424. Again, that's 888-897-WGBH.
So whoever you can help right now, I promise it'll make a really big difference. We're nearing the end of this campaign. It's very short. Now's the time to do your part, because your support is what keeps you and your entire community connected to the in-depth news and unique storytelling here. So call 888-897-9424 or give online at WGBHnews.org.
Hi, this is Jack Spear. When it comes to things you pay for, it can be easy to think that public radio is free. After all, you don't get a bill from us. There's no corporate owner telling us what we should report. In fact, we pretty much embody the idea of free speech. But the only way we can bring you the news every day is if you help pay for it with your voluntary contribution. Members pay for more than half of what it costs for us to cover and broadcast the news. But not all of you out there support us, so today we're asking you to contribute what you can, even for those who can't. Your contribution means we can keep free speech freely available for everyone. Thank you.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Bruce Marx has been called a flamethrower. Actually, he's been called worse. He's also been described as a crusader and a fierce advocate for struggling homeowners. He's been a thorn in the side of big banks. But in a relatively new twist, a big bank, one of the biggest, has been making things look a lot rosier for people who can't afford to buy a home. Bruce is executive director of the nonprofit Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America. They've received $10 billion so far, $10 billion, I said, in funding from Bank of America to make loans on its own terms, meaning on NACA's own terms over the next decade. Bruce is here with us in Studio 3. Bruce, great to see you.
Jim, it's great to see you. Marjorie, it's great to see you.
Bruce has got a lot of juicy stories about Jim Browdy. He's going to
have a couple of beers, and he's going to tell me all about it.
Yeah, so it's
absolutely. Marjorie, I can tell you things that no one else knows out
there. Fine, just not here.
Good.
Thank you, Bruce.
Oh, good. So I'm so impressed, Bruce. You managed to get $10 million from the
Bank
of America.
$10 billion,
excuse me. John Kerry's over there, only gets $1 billion for the Ukraine. You get $10 billion. How'd you get $10 billion, and what are you going to do with it, please?
Well, you know, as you know, Jim was saying, yes, we've been called all kinds of things. We engage in nonviolent bank terrorism, and we also do the operations for the banks better than they do. So here, what it sounds too good to be true, but it's a mortgage product that is no down payment, no closing costs, no fees, always at a below market interest rate. So today's rate is less than 4%. We never look at someone's credit score. And we do the operations for the banks because these banks, they just can't get it done and no one trusts the banks.
So you're essentially doing exactly what got this country in trouble a number of years ago. But your view is you're not going to bring down the whole economy. I'm serious. How will you do better exactly by giving loans to people without checking credit scores, as you say, people who under at least new regulations are not, wouldn't otherwise qualify? How are you going to ensure that there's not the same outcome that we experienced less than a decade ago?
Well, we've been doing it for 20 years, Jim, and we have the best performance in any mortgage product in the industry. So if you provide a prime loan who the industry considers to be a subprime borrower, and you
meaning a risky borrower under traditional definitions.
Then they become a prime borrower. But look what built the suburbs after World War II. It was VA loans. What are VA loans? No down payment, full documentation mortgages, right? So what we have to do is we have to take the NACA mortgage, this $10 billion plus $3 billion from Citigroup, $13 billion, and make that the standard to rebuild the neighborhoods that have been devastated from the financial crisis, because it's full doc underwriting. But you look at people's individual circumstances, because if you say to someone, well, they've got a very low credit score because they had to bring their child to the emergency room and they can't pay their medical costs. Well, that's not a negative reflection on them being a homeowner. That's a negative reflection on that we have a lousy healthcare system in this country.
So what do you do for that person to make sure that he or she doesn't default as they would in a traditional setting? How do you help that person?
Because what we look at is we say, first thing, are you ready for home ownership? So we look at the payments that they're responsible for that are within their control. So if they have made their payments over the last 12 months, we say, you're ready for home ownership. And then we say, what are you able to afford? So we take your rent and we look at that and we say, how much can you save more every month? So we really qualify
them
for what they can afford.
Training workshops and that sort of
stuff.
And
we do training and everything's free and they get counseling. But so we have this $13 billion, Bank of America, Citigroup, and more to say, here, let's set the standard in this country for how we can do lending the right way, and our performance is better than anything out there in this country.
We're talking with Bruce Marks, who's the executive director of the nonprofit Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America. I read, Bruce, and please explain this to people, that one of the things you do is have like a little insurance policy if a person that gets a mortgage through you loses their job or gets sick or something. So how does that work?
Right. So what we have is, you know, there's a scam out there, and it is called private mortgage insurance.
Right.
Where homeowners
really?
Pay...
Really? Is it a scam?
Oh,
I've been paying it for years.
I know you shouldn't. Oh, you might have to in your mortgage, but you shouldn't pay it. But because it's a scam, because it's for the lenders, and it really incentivizes the lenders to foreclose faster. So we said, but there should be an insurance fund out there. So what we do is we have funds that are saying if someone cannot make their mortgage payment, they go in front of a peer committee. And with that, and they will make a decision to provide actual money to the homeowners to get through. If they lost their job, they have an emergency, whatever that is, or they are out there losing a tenant, you know, they can get this financial assistance to get them over that hump.
Okay.
But, you know, with all the stuff that we are out there doing, Marjorie, you know what's crazy? We've had the biggest fights that we've had to have is not just with the banks. And, you know, we go after the banks. We go to the CEO's homes. We hold them personally accountable. We do all that. It's with the regulators.
You're publicizing someone's affair to their neighbors, Bruce.
Hey, bankers. Is that correct?
Better behave yourself,
when
Bruce.
When you say absolutely,
you know, payback.
How do you judge it? This is why people call you, I mean, Phil Graham, former senator, called you an extortionist. You've been called an urban terrorist. You even used the term yourself. Why is that kind of tactic? How do you defend that to yourself?
Well, because it's personal. You know, and when these banks, when these CEOs, when they foreclose on somebody, well, it's personal. So what's wrong with going on a Sunday morning to John Maxhouse, head of Morgan Stanley and others, with 400 to 500 homeowners who are impacted by their decisions and say, we want you to meet the homeowners that you're foreclosing on because it's personal. So you have to hold them personally accountable because we used to have this standard in America called personal accountability. Well, the CEOs of these banks have to be held to that same standard, but they live in their gated communities and all that. The problem that they have is the people who are the security guards and the police are NACA members.
So what happened when you showed up with the 400, 500 people that day?
He ended up running away in his Ferrari. So we took over his front yard and all that, and we get a call 20 minutes later and says, we're going to agree to the terms and we're going to modify mortgages out there.
You know, Bruce, one of the things for those who are listening and saying this is a noble act, even if they don't like your tactics, they say, yeah, but this is a pipe dream kind of thing. New York Times, in this recent piece about you about a month ago, or actually less, says the foreclosure rate on NACA loans is roughly 1/3 of what it is for traditional mortgages. Mm-hmm. So obviously this thing works. People who – I mean, Bruce was Bostonian of the Year on the cover of the Boston Globe magazine a couple of years ago. But most times we see you, even though you're Boston-based, you're JP-based, right?
Yes.
Isn't that where you are in Jamaica Plain?
Still there.
We see you on the evening national news where literally thousands and thousands of people in Atlanta or in Florida or in Los Angeles, wherever it is, are coming to meetings to begin the process to either avoid foreclosure, which was your primary mission in your earlier incarnation,
right,
but now it's to allow low and moderate income people to become homeowners who otherwise couldn't be. What are you doing at those? What happens at those things? What do people get out of them?
Well, you know, one thing, and to take a quick step back, because as we've known each other for many years, Jim, you know, we were the first organization through the hotel workers that actually coined...
Where we both worked two decades ago,
right,
is how we met. Yeah.
Right. Coined the term predatory lending, mm-hmm, back in the second mortgage scam that was going on in Boston and take on Fleet Bank back in those days that, you know, you and others were a big part of. So now we come forward to that, to what's going on in the mortgage crisis. So we said, okay, the way to do it is that the government has failed to help the homeowners who have an unaffordable mortgage. So what we said is that we got legally binding agreements with all the major lenders out there, Bank of America, Citi, Wells, all of them, and Chase and all those players. And we get them into a huge convention center, and we counsel them, and the same day they go back to their servicer, their lender, and they achieve an affordable solution, saving $500, sometimes over.
You mean a renegotiation of the terms of the mortgage.
Absolutely. So here is an unaffordable mortgage that they're able to bring down to an interest rate as low as 2%, and they're actually able to reduce the outstanding principal by $10,000, $50,000, $100,000 and more, saving on their mortgage payment $500 to $1,000 a month in their mortgage payments. So we've had over 130 of what we call these American Dream events. They're 5 days. And people who, everybody who comes, have already tried and failed to work with their lender.
Yeah, but I never understood about this, Bruce.
Exactly. Why would they rather have people foreclose
exactly.
than renegotiate?
I never understood.
Neither
well, it's
I.
great, the service you provide. Why don't the banks understand that it's in their self-interest to not have a blighted neighborhood and people who end up having to leave their house? I don't get it.
There's no more dysfunctional industry than the banking industry. I mean, they are too big to manage. They're not regulated in a real way. So the fact of the matter is, yes, it's in their interest to actually modify the mortgages. It's in their interest not to foreclose, but they can't get out of their own way. I mean, we've met with the CEOs. They admit they just can't operate this. And so it's so what they have done is they've outsourced it to NACA.
Because they're wrapped up in all their rules, is that it? So there's too many people involved, too many cooks kind of deal, is that
well,
it?
Well, the CEOs of these banks never understood the servicing part.
Okay.
Because they never made enough money on that. So they never put the resources, they never put the technology, they never made it work. And now what they're doing is they're going back and they say, we have to learn this, but they're not willing to invest in that. So the only way to do it, so in a sense, we've been very successful. We've helped over 250,000, a quarter of a million homeowners modify their mortgages, saving their mortgages, saving their homes. But where we haven't been successful is saying make the NACA standard the national standard. So if someone comes to NACA, they get a great solution. If they go straight to the banks, they're more likely to be foreclosed on.
You know, Barney Frank.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about that. The whole Barney Frank.
Go ahead, sure.
Barney Frank, of course, many people blamed Barney Frank for the mortgage crisis after 2008 when people were being foreclosed on all over the country. And he, in a piece in The New Yorker in 2009, said, I told you homeownership is a nice thing. It's not suitable for everybody. Seeming to do a turnaround because we always thought homeownership was the way to go.
Right.
Why is homeownership such a big deal? Why not say to people who are in precarious situations, you know, pay the rent, you don't have to worry about fixing the place up, have the landlord deal with that? Why is that not the way to go?
Well, because one, we don't have very good rental housing in this country. So if you go to Europe and other places, there's really decent rental housing. But the other reason is people are invested. People really take ownership of that. So they want to be concerned with what goes on in your street. You know, how's the property value? They're really invested. They take ownership. But to take a step back, I testified on September 12th of 2000, 13 years ago, in front of the House Financial Services Committee in Congress, saying that this crisis was going to happen.
Which Barney Frank ended up chairing ultimately,
yes,
correct?
That's right. So, and I was attacked by Maxine Waters and the Democrats out there.
Congresswoman from California.
Right, to do that because, you know, and I said the biggest problem is that you're going to have Fannie Mae and the GSEs, you know, Fannie and Freddie, we're going to bail them out because they're buying mortgages that were structured to fail. They bought them from Bank of America, Countrywide, and others. So it was apparent. And how did we know that? Because we did so many loans in Lawrence, but people were refinancing out there, and we couldn't get any more business because people were now getting other mortgages out there that we knew were structured to fail.
Because of these balloon payments.
Absolutely,
and they didn't have a fixed rate sort of thing. That was the problem with a lot of right. these people, right?
Yeah, and they blamed the homeowners. They blamed the homeowners. Well, the homeowners shouldn't have gotten into that crisis, into that mortgage. But there's an important date, and that date is February of 2007. That's when the crisis started to hit, and all of a sudden people knew, boy, what's going on? Well, what happened? It wasn't like we all suddenly had new mortgages out there and new homeowners. It's because that's when the mortgages doubled and tripled in their payment.
Now,
so
I just
they were structured to fail.
Yeah, again, I've known Bruce for a long time. I've never seen Bruce in a shirt that does not have some insignia or something on it. Just to describe, since we're not on television, Bruce is wearing a black shirt. On one side, it says America's Best Mortgage, www.naca.com. The other side is NACA with a couple of eyes looking at you saying, financial predators, beware. Now, speaking of beware.
It's a great shirt.
And by the way, in a second,
I should have bought some extra stuff.
For those who are out there saying, how do I get in touch with them? How do I get involved? In a minute, get your either your whatever you record things on ready, and Bruce will give you the contact information in a minute. Before that, I'm sure people, based on the introduction, are saying, how did you get Bank of America to write you a $10 billion check?
That's
essentially
a lot of money.
Why'd they do that, and how did you make it happen? I don't mean all the tactics, but why did they decide this was a wise move for them?
Well, we were doing a campaign back in the early 90s, and it was against Eddie Crutchfield of First Union. And that's the guy who we expose he's having an affair with
and all that.
So we
He must have loved you.
So, and we call him Fast Eddie because it's so quick to get to the rich people. But so in that campaign, end up getting a call from Hugh McCall, head of Bank of America, Nations Bank at that point. And after a long story, you know, I said all bankers are evil. He said all nonprofits want a handout. He said, if what you do is true and we'll verify it, we'll be your biggest supporter. So he did an initial $500 million. 2 years later, it's $3 billion. Then they increased it to $10 billion because it works.
So on the merits, I know you've supported some mergers and things that have been controversial among some housing advocates because of your faith in these banks. Did they do it preemptively because they're worried they were your next target? Or did they do it, or maybe these are both these reasons, or did they do it because you really, in your estimation, you really convinced them of the merits of your approach? Or is it both, I assume?
It is both, because you can have the best product and the best program out there, but if you don't get their attention, it does not go anywhere, because you need their money. You need their capital to be able to do that. So it's both. You get their attention, but then if you don't do the operations well, then you can't get it done.
Do you have NACA underwear, too, or what are you just
absolutely.
Sure?
I'm sure.
Okay, fine.
You're not showing up in anybody's house this weekend
with
500 people, are you,
we're not
Bruce?
Saying that.
Oh, okay.
We're always in the fight. We're always
okay.
pushing it.
Bruce Marks, if there are people either concerned about their existing mortgage or it's a low-income family or people know a low-income family that's dying to buy a home and they think they would fit your criteria, what do? How do they get in touch with you?
They have to go to our website, NACA.com. That's the best way to do it. So anybody, if you have an unaffordable mortgage, you got to go to our website and start that process of the home save process. If you are a home buyer, you will be able to get a mortgage through NACA because the underwriting is so flexible, we will get it done. Go to NACA.com.
Okay, let's get rid of Bruce before he tells any stories about our relationship 2 decades ago. Goodbye, Bruce Marks, congratulations. It's
nice
great to
you.
Talk to you, Bruce.
Thank you for having me.
Executive Director of the Nonprofit Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America. Great fun talking to you, Bruce. Up next, we're going to ask you, when it comes to teenagers, have summers become as high stakes as the SATs when it comes to getting into college? Are the carefree days of summer a relic for college-bound kids? That's next on 89.7. 7WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Johnny Dollar,
Gunsmoke.
The sounds of old-time radio are reaching a new generation thanks to Ed Walker.
Some of the kids that send me emails say, we put our transistor radio under the pillow and listen to your show until we go to sleep.
Mining the golden age of radio on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4, here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Pop Money, available at Citizens Bank, a service where users can send, request, and receive money with an email address or smartphone. Information at popmoney.com or citizensbank.com. And Northeastern University, where researchers are untangling the complexities of climate change to measure the true cost to the world's cities. Learn how Northeastern is making tomorrow happen at northeastern.edu/tomorrow.
Listening to Jim and Marjorie at lunchtime is kind of like having a lunch date with my well-informed aunt and uncle, and I realized that I needed to start contributing to our lunch date by becoming a sustaining member. Hi, my name's Amanda from Dorchester, Massachusetts, and I'm a sustainer for WGBH because I think it's important to be an engaged member of my community. and it really just takes a couple of minutes to figure out how you can best give for the coming year, and you get to pick a gift, which is also really exciting, and it's a way to advertise that I'm an active member of the WGBH community and be part of the community that's giving back to the radio station that gives me so much.
Call 888-897-9424 or do your part online at WGBHnews.org. It's actually quite simple. This is our March community campaign. We're racing toward the finish line. I am Jim Browdy here with Marjorie Egan every single day from noon to 2, and we're joined by our colleague and friend, Kim Saltmarsh. Hey, Kim.
Hey, Jim. Yeah, so you just heard Amanda talking there, and she did this beautiful testimonial and said, you know, it's kind of cool. I get to support this type of programming and support Jim and Marjorie, who she loves, but also she gets to pick a great gift. And you know what? I hope you'll pick this gift. It's $150 right now. We're going to say thanks with a pair of tickets to see Judy Collins. We've been talking about it all day, but the thing is, you only have 41 minutes left to take advantage of it. And you know what? We only have 24 pairs left. This show sold out so fast. It was so popular that Judy herself was like, let's add another show for WGBH supporters. We, of course, were so excited. So this is the only place that you can get these tickets. And it's one of the very, very last chances to get them. I can't stress that enough. So you've got 40 minutes, and 24 pairs left. The show's happening Sunday, September 21st at the Wilbur Theater. That's the 3 p.m. show. So I hope that you won't miss out. You got to call for it, 888-897-9424. You can't get these anywhere else, 888-897-WGBH.
And we want to thank all of you who just gave: Carol in South Hamilton, Bertha in Attleboro, Rich in Rutland, Pat in Warwick, Rhode Island, Martha in West Falmouth, John in Peabody, Mark in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, and Virginia in Boxborough. Thank you so, so much for donating. And don't miss out on the Judy Collins tickets. You'll be automatically entered as well into that America's Test Kitchen contest. Keep in mind, this campaign is almost over. 888-897-9424 is the number, or give online at WGBHnews.org. You know, you can never say thanks enough. That's why we wanted to thank you guys just now. We'll keep thanking you. It's what this campaign is all about, this short campaign. It'll be over in just a few days, and I'd really love the chance to say thank you to you. So right now, today, I hope you'll support this routine of yours and many of your family, friends, and neighbors by supporting 89.7 with a gift in any amount. It's appreciated by so many.
By the way, I'd like to say some thank yous, too, but you're grabbing them all as soon as Kim walks in the studio.
Right. There's actually one more.
Totally.
So,
well, good.
Yeah, you can thank them.
Great.
We'll
so incidentally, while it's being handed to me, you're listening to GBH, obviously, during this fundraiser, which is a pretty good indicator, at least to me, that you really like public radio. Liking what you hear is the best reason to make a gift. And when you make a gift, you're not just doing something for you, you're doing something for others in our community too. So please, really please, call 888-897-9424, or you can give online at WGBHnews.org.
Hey, Jim, say thanks to Nan. She's in Newburyport.
Hey, Nan in Newburyport, thank you from me, Kim, Marjorie, and all the people at WGBH. Yeah, thanks,
thank
Nan.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And you know what that means? We're now down to 23 pairs left because she just took two Judy Collins tickets. So this is the day to give if you were thinking about it. Again, this is another show that Judy opened back up because the other one sold out so quickly.
Really
so a
great
gift. It's so great. And a gift of $150 right now is going to get you a pair of tickets to see Judy Collins. You have 38 minutes left. We're done with Boston Public Radio at 2 o'clock. So you have 38 minutes left to take advantage of the Judy Collins tickets. There's also lots of great incentives, right? If you give a gift in any amount right now, you're automatically going to be entered into that America's Test Kitchen contest we've been telling you about. That's two VIP tickets, invitations to see their America's Test Kitchen taping. So that's really exciting. Other great incentives like the WGBH t-shirt. That was also so popular on Tuesday. We have a few of those left. So lots of great incentives. But of course, the real reason is that you believe in this mission. And that mission is quality broadcasting in this community. I hope you feel that's worthy of your support. I hope you'll get in on the Judy Collins tickets. 37 minutes left and 23 pairs to go. 888 888-897-9424. You got to call for the tickets, 888-897-WGBH. You can always do your part online at WGBHnews.org.
Well, there are a lot of great incentives. I mean, T-shirts, Test Kitchen, Judy Collins tickets.
List goes on and on.
It's really great. But the real reason, of course, is because you believe in public broadcasting. It helps you get through the day. Your commute helps your family, friends, and neighbors do the same. Our March Community Campaign is almost over, so we really, really hope you'll get involved right now. I'll give you the number and the website one more time, 888-897-9424, or online at WGBHnews.org.
Hi, it's Christopher Kimball from America's Test Kitchen. Lots of cultures have their very own way of giving thanks for food, rituals and words that mean something very special. And hearing my compliments to the chef always warmed my heart. Well, 89.7 is on a mission to say thank you to 3,000 WGBH supporters. And when you add your name to that list by making a gift in any amount, you'll be automatically entered to win two tickets to a taping of America's Test Kitchen TV show at our Test Kitchen in Brookline. Also, a copy of our cooking school cookbook signed by the entire cast, and subscriptions to both of our magazines, Cooks Illustrated as well as Cooks Country. To do your part and be entered into the contest, call 888-897-9424 or go to our website, WGBHnews.org. Thanks and good luck.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. With getting into college becoming more competitive than ever, and I'm sure you know it, our summer is now the newest frontier to score points for college-bound kids. There's a terrific piece by Beth Tytel in yesterday's Globe. Summer fun takes a backseat to college resume building. Does it ever? Do you feel guilty if your kid spends the summer doing something ordinary, like bagging groceries or actually experiencing life? Should your kid instead be in Costa Rica, I don't know, saving the rainforest or at some academic boot camp for $4,000 for a couple of weeks, writing code and mastering multiple languages? Our number is 877-301-8970. If you're a student or a recent student and you made one of these decisions, or if you've got a kid who had to make one of these decisions, it's what matters more, building up the resume or maybe expending one of your final free summers experiencing a little bit of life locally? You're not going to backpack across Europe when you're 60. Would you agree, Marjorie?
No, probably not. But Beth Tytel, who's a terrific writer, she focuses in on the 17-year-old high school senior whose summer vacation, summer work, you know, to get into college plans fell through, and his parents went bananas, and he said it was the most stressful summer vacation he'd ever had. He'd already studied electrical engineering at Skidmore one summer. He'd argued in mock trials at Columbia University. He developed apps at MIT and screened patients for tuberculosis in Thailand. And one summer, things fall through. He doesn't, you know, do anything spectacular like this. And they're on his back constantly saying that he's not going to be able to get into college. I mean, I think these people all sound crazy. This just sounds nuts to me. Listen to this. $4,000 boot camp where they practice taking SATs all summer.
What's the hourly rate for one of those trainers, too?
$275 an hour to consult professional summer advisors. And you know what I think? I think there are so many people making money off everybody's paranoia about not getting into the right school that they're perpetuating this notion that if you don't do all these things, it's just all over for you. I think it's crazy.
877-301-8970. Which side are you on in this summer conundrum for your kid or for you yourself, when you're applying to college? You know, remember who Marilee Jones was, Marjorie, from MIT? She was the admissions dean.
Yes.
Who was beloved. She'd written a book called Less Stress, More Success. She ultimately ended up leaving because she had phonied something on a resume decades earlier, something minor. It was really a sad story. She added something to the – this is MIT. Talk about stress of all places. She added to the list of items you had to fill in on the application to MIT – tell us about something you do just for the pleasure of it. How great is that? How great must this woman have been? The stress level. I mean, I have two kids just started. Well, one's in her junior year, but two kids who started college in the last several years. The stress level to build the resume, to do good things, not just for the good of the thing, but also for the good of the resume, is so intense. You never have, unless you're loaded, you never have another opportunity in your life to just experience life, to be part of the world around you instead of like grinding yourself into like nothing so you get into a top tier school. It's ridiculous.
For all those people who want their children to go to Harvard, the dean of admissions at Harvard is quoted in this piece. He says he's become so concerned about these summer activities that he now, on the university's website, they urge families to, quote, bring summer back with a, quote, old-fashioned summer job, or perhaps just relax to gain strength for the school year ahead. I mean,
do you think he walks the walk or just talks? Do you think if you submitted a resume and an application and you're equal to kid number B, letter B, and your kid A, and kid B did go to Costa Rica to save the rainforest, is he or she going to move ahead of you? I worry they might.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, to me, if you look at someone that went to Costa Rica to save the rainforest, I think you should cross someone off your list because it's so obvious to me that there's something so obnoxious about that to me.
My kid went to Costa Rica to do turtle things a couple of years ago. Thank you, Marjorie.
Okay.
I really appreciate
I'm
doing
sorry.
It. She went because she wanted.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Talk about offending a friend.
I'm sorry. I didn't know your kid went to Costa Rica.
She collected turtle eggs on
it was
the
wonderful.
Shore.
It was wonderful
she
that
did.
She went there.
She had time for life.
But listen to this. This is a Western kid. Well, to me, you know what? To me,
it's true, by the way.
She did go to Costa Rica?
She loved every minute. I mean, it was sort of half... Go ahead. I'm not going to put you on the spot.
Okay, I'm sorry. I wasn't.
No, it's okay. It's okay.
You know, my kids didn't do that.
Okay,
maybe they would be at Harvard if they did.
Fine.
But anyway, listen to this kid from Weston. She was 18 years old, and this story says she approached her summers with the focus of a professional branding specialist.
One of my least favorite words.
She spent one summer interning with a doctor at Mass General, another summer as a marine biology camp counselor at the New England Aquarium, and then she did something about the taking care of the environment. Well, you know what happened with her?
No.
She gets an early to Duke. So I guess in her case, it paid off. But listen to what she said. When I was sitting on the train going to Boston on a nice day, I wished I could be spending time with friends or going to the beach. But in the end, I knew that I was doing what I thought was important.
Good. Let's take a few quick calls. Anne from Shrewsbury, you're first on this topic anyway, on Boston Public Radio. Thanks so much for the call. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I just have three quick thoughts.
Sure.
I have three kids. I have a junior. I have a graduate who's going to grad school next year, a junior in college, and a daughter leaving for college this summer. And I just said to her the other day, we had a conversation. I said, what do you want to do for your summer? She said, oh, I haven't really felt like I've had a summer. She had surgery last year. I said, you know what? Take it off. Work at an ice cream shop. Take it off. You know, why does everything have to be done in these kids' lives before they turn 21? Like, every experience has to be done. They have to travel. They have to volunteer. Everything has to be done before they even get a chance to grow up.
And can I tell you something? I love that you gave your kid that advice. Unfortunately, she is never going to get a job. No, I'm kidding. You are in my mind, the dream parent. That's exactly what you should say to the kid. Enjoy it. It's going to be your last opportunity. I think it's great. And did she take your advice, or it's the summer coming up?
No, she's taking my advice.
Great.
My oldest son, who graduated from college 2 years ago, had no idea what he was going to do, has spent time volunteering and having a sort of a job, in quotations, in Washington, D.C., has just gotten accepted to BC grad school. And, you know, there was no stress from us. It was like, do what you love, and it's going to work out.
Well, by the way, let's be clear here. And thanks for your call, Ann. Good luck with your third kid in college. If a kid really wants to do something and is not doing it because of the pressure or stress he or she is experiencing about college, then of course do it. I'm not saying people shouldn't do something they really care about. But when you do it solely because you're concerned and you're fretting that you're not going to get into your top choice school, it shortens your life. I mean, it just does. Sophia, you're in Lowell. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hi. So I'm a student at UMass Lowell, and I actually, and in between my high school years and coming here, I went to France with Experiment in International Living, and I totally see where you're coming from, but I do think that there's some value to those trips. For example, being in France, I got to see the world rather than the American way of thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, there's we're so money hungry here and professional and all like, you know, all that stuff. And in France, they're much more about like the quality of living, and you get to see people's, negative aspects of life too, which I think is very important for us to know as Americans.
Well, you know,
Sophia,
what, Marjorie,
how'd you finance the trip to Paris, to France?
How did I finance it? I actually got a scholarship from them.
And from a mentoring program I was in, Framingham High School, called Step Up to Excellence.
Because that's the big thing. I mean, if you cannot get a scholarship or some kind of help financing it, I mean, what normal family can afford a $4,000-plus boot camp?
Well, can I tell you something?
Go ahead.
No, finish your thought. I'm sorry.
I totally see where you're coming from with the financing, but I think there are opportunities that you can fund it. So I think here in America, there's so many scholarships and nobody applies to them.
Hey, Sophia, thanks. By the way, the major difference, I know you're going to say this, Marjorie, so I'll beat you to the punch, is what Sophia must have experienced in Paris is the three-hour dinner as opposed to the three-minute dinner, which is typical for America. You know, by the way, just on this note, we're going to have him in soon. Alan Solomont, former ambassador to Spain and now head of the Tisch College of Citizenship and something at Tufts. I interviewed him the other day. They have this bridge program, which answers your question, where a bunch of kids, once they're admitted to Tufts, and other schools are adopting this as well, once they're admitted to Tufts, it's called the 4+1 program. The first year, you go do something good, and they subsidize it for low and moderate income students who are admitted who can't afford. Every college should do that, as far as I'm concerned. You'll hear from Solomon soon.
That is a great idea. You know what they're doing in this story?
What's that?
They're sailing on Arctic research vessels. They're learning conservation management in Zimbabwe.
Can I tell you something?
God.
Can I tell you something?
Your kid went to Zimbabwe.
She did, yeah. No, she did. She did go to Costa Rica to count and catalog those turtle eggs. She did not go to Zimbabwe.
It's important. Turtle eggs are very important. Are we done?
We'll take one more quick one. Very quick. Rebecca, you're in Warwick, Rhode Island. Quickly, if you can. Thanks so much for the call.
Sure. I'm just calling from the flip side. I don't have children. I graduated in 2001, and it was really hard to get a job at the time. I had a degree in advertising, and immediately I had to go out and pay the rent. So I got a job at a little local candy store in the North End and worked in the basement cutting up fudge, and I was deemed the marketing person. And then from there, one thing led to another, got another job. But I think the most important thing for people to consider when we're hiring is for you to go out, get a job, have some work ethic, stick to it, and build up those experiences along the way and not worry so much about what you look like on paper, because it's really how you present in person.
That's a great point.
Really lost.
Rebecca, and I'm dying to know, when you're cutting up the fudge in the basement, how much did you eat?
Way too much.
Who wouldn't? Hey, Rebecca, great call. Thanks for adding to the conversation.
Can you imagine being a fudge cutter-upper? Oh, my God. It would be just unbelievable.
Fudge cutter-upper.
A million cavities and would gain 20 pounds. Anyway,
a lot of happiness.
Up next, Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam joins us for Open Mic. More Pope envy, among other things, is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
I'm Marco Werman. A woman from West Virginia says she listens to the world to understand what's going on in the world.
When I listened this week, there were 3 stories in 1 hour show about the Ukraine. And that kind of coverage about an area that's in such immediate turmoil was very helpful for me.
We try to help understanding Ukraine on the world.
This afternoon at 3, here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Leahy Health, committed to providing leading-edge care right in your community, helping you become and stay healthy all through your life. You can learn more at LeahyHealth.org. That's LeahyHealth.org.
This is 89.7 WGBH, your home for public radio.
This is not the best weather to commute in.
No?
No.
But Pearson isn't the only biker on Boston area roads this winter. Many of them choose their bikes over cars or the T.
To be honest, on the big storms that we've had this year, I think I've gotten home faster on a bicycle.
This is 89.7 WGBH, your home for public radio. Please support it. Here's how.
It's easy to do, actually, at WGBHnews.org, or you just do a quick call to 888-897-9424. I'm Jim Browdy. Marjorie Egan's here. You're listening to WGBH during our March community campaign, and we're getting close to the end of it. Here to help me encourage you to get involved is Kim Solmarsh. Hello, Kim.
Hey, Jim. So, you know, we've got 23 minutes left, and I have to tell you, we're now down to 8 pairs of Judy Collins. 8 pairs of Judy Collins. Lots of people have been taking advantage of them when they call 888-897-9424. And Jim has a laundry list of people he'd like to say thank you to.
And I'm so glad you gave it to me, Kim. Thank you. Cassandra in Mashpee, James in Raynham, Kathleen in Burlington, Christine in Rockport. Thank you all. And thank you, Helen in Westwood, Don in Hudson, New Hampshire, Sydney in Natick, and Catherine in Monument Beach. You don't know how much it means to all of us here. It really does.
Yeah, it really, really does. And look, in the next 22 minutes, I hope that you'll be one of the next 8 to take advantage of the Judy Collins tickets when you give a gift of support of $150 right now. As I've been telling you throughout the show, the previous show sold out, and it was so popular that Judy added another show, this show, and this is the only place you can score tickets, and we've only have 8 pairs left. That's all we have. So it's happening Sunday, September 21st at the Wilbur Theater. That's at 3 p.m. This is one of your very, very, very last chances to get Judy Collins tickets for when she's in Boston. 8 pairs left, 22 minutes to go. You got a call to get them, 888-897-9424.
So I want to be really clear about the goal for this campaign. It is to say thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you if you've already pitched in. And if you haven't, thanks in advance for considering it. This is a very short campaign. We set a goal to get 3,000 thank yous out before it's all said and done. But here's the thing, with just a little bit of ways to go, we need to hear from 1,200 of you. That's 1,200 of you. And I would be honored to announce your name as the next Make Our Thank You List. All you have to do is call 888-897 or 9424, 888-897-9424, or give online at wgbhnews.org.
Now, I want to say you only have 7 sets of tickets, not 8, because I just realized I'm going to buy a pair. I don't want to get shut out of this.
So
you're down,
Jim,
you're down to
quick.
7. Okay,
yep,
fine.
7.
Now, here's a fact if you don't know this. 7 out of every $10 that GBH spends on daily operations come from listener contributions. You already listened, so how about taking some action on that contributing part? It's quick. It's easy. Here's the best part. It really makes you feel good. I know Marjorie and I are contributors from our past. It does feel great. It's for a great cause, and it makes us happy, too. 888-897-9424, or you can give online quite simply at wgbhnews.org.
That's such a great point. I mean, look, we've got these great incentives like the WGBH t-shirt we brought back. That can be yours for a sustaining gift of $12.50 a month. We've got the now 7 pairs, because Jim's vowing to buy a pair of tickets of Judy Collins. So we've got these great incentives, right? But the real reason is that you believe this community deserves to be informed and inspired and educated. These are the things that you get when you listen to, let's say, Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. If you feel that this community deserves that, then I hope you'll step up right now and show your support. And of course, we've got these great incentives along the way. A gift of $150 gets you a Judy Collins ticket. We have 7 pairs left, so I hope you take advantage in the next 20 minutes. 888-897-9424. Again, that's 888-897-WGBH to get you in on the Judy Collins tickets. A gift in any amount also works online at WGBHnews.org.
So we all put things off, but in this case, I hope you'll consider doing your part right now, because this short campaign is almost over, and don't miss out on all these great specials Kim's just told you about. 888-897-9424, or do your good deed online at WGBHnews.org.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with Morning Edition from NPR News. You know, there's an old New Yorker cartoon. It shows two people standing at a party. They're talking, and the man says to the woman, "It's not just my opinion. It's the opinion of somebody I heard on NPR." You hear something, and during a conversation, the subject comes up again, and you realize you know what's going on. You can talk about it. You understand the story. It's a pretty common refrain among people, because this is where you come to get information in context. You rely on public radio, and we rely on you. Without your contributions, public radio reporters cannot afford to tell the stories that you want to hear. And that's the way it should be. You support public radio, you get the value. Your community does too.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie in here with us in Studio 3, as is every Thursday for Open Mic, is Globe columnist Alex Beeman. Again, when Marjorie and I, Alex, were preparing for today's show, we just got to laugh out of how appropriate it is. Your name is Alex Beam, because Alex Beam, sort of like Alex Trebek, asks the hard questions and has all the answers. Now, before, Marjorie, you say anything to Alex, before they're playing during the fundraising pledge pitch about a half hour ago, something about Judy Collins, and they have an excerpt from yesterday's show. And I have to admit, I was a little overexcited. So when I was praising her for my favorite Beatles cover, which I called all my life. I get a text from what I thought was a friend of mine saying, or in my life, as it's sometimes called, which totally threw, oh, it's from Alex Beam. Why did you feel that was necessary, Alex? I was aware that I'd gotten the name.
Well, why didn't you just correct it in real time?
Because I was embarrassed. Okay. I was embarrassed, and I hope people would just forget it.
Beatles songs in world history.
No,
it's extremely beautiful.
I made a little mistake.
And you bleeped it up, for the record.
I did, for
the
record,
and yet had no stones to correct yourself. By the way, I'm sorry, where's my eco bag? What? Huh?
We'll get you an eco bag,
Alex. I'm begging.
I reveled in your correcting, Jim. You know why?
Why is that?
Because Jim is always correcting me. So I felt, yes.
I have one in my back pocket, actually, but I don't know if this is the time to spring it. Jim, no, Jim credited, he's at MIT with the discovery of the human genome, but it's actually Wally Gilbert, widely known.
Is that really true?
Harvard's Wally
Gilbert. I was going to correct that a little later in the show, but it's...
It's great. Now we need people to listen 2 weeks later to
Thank
catch
you,
correct.
You're
so
okay.
Welcome. Yeah.
So we read your great column, Computer Generated Nonsense. It was a riot, as it always is, Alex Beam, but we weren't really sure... What?
Right. It's exactly. We turned to each other.
Really
sure. It was
you
great.
Were saying, okay, we read all about the computer-generated nonsense in a million different contexts. And then we thought, is he saying that there's a lot of it? Is that what he's saying?
I don't know. Even the editor sent me an email yesterday saying, does this mean the end of the Boston Globe op-ed page?
What was your
what
point
was your
exactly?
point, Alex?
I don't know. My point. I saw that that thing has been out there in the ether sphere for about 6 or 7 days, this admission that the relatively prestigious scientific journal community has been publishing papers generated by random computer programs that are just complete idiocy. And I don't know. It just kind of seized me. It was terrible because it's the kind of column you want to have written immediately, and yet I stewed over it, you know, for a number of days because I only write once a week. And then I thought, God, I should really do something that's like more important, like about Ukraine or something. You know, something people really care about.
So why didn't
about.
You do that, by the way?
Because I hate that stuff.
You do.
It just bores me to death.
Could you do me a favor? Could you do a dramatic reading of the end of your column, the portion
oh,
that's about yourself?
This is great.
You don't have to read the whole thing. Read a selected part.
This is a set piece, though. I mean, I always do this.
Go ahead.
Because I always feel if anyone has to be trashed, it has to be
Fine,
Alex.
Just read
I'll
ahead,
try to be
read
quick.
It.
All right.
Fine, thank
so,
you.
So, yeah, okay. I'm sorry, I kind of stalled so long. Airtime's not pressed. The editors of the Boston Globe, in a tiny note artfully buried at the bottom of page 2, that's for insiders, of course, because we put all our corrections
yes,
there,
you
unlike
do.
On the air, where yours end up, admitted that half of the hundreds of columns written by Alex Beam in his centuries-long stint at the newspaper, I mean, really, who's
Go
not
ahead.
Tired
Just
of Alex
reading.
Beam, had been purged, quote, so much of Beam's work was borderline unreadable, the editor's note stated, quote, he tossed around words like, quote, obscurantist, atavistic, whatever that means,
yeah.
and seriatim, as if he was auditioning for tenure in the English department at Middlesex Community College. But in the end, a lot of his work read like computer-generated nonsense. That's really my watchword. I wish I could write a column
okay.
with that title. Okay,
what's
fine,
seriatim, yeah. please?
Seriatim means in a row. That's like when you're describing
Thank you.
The affairs you've had with members either of the same sex or the opposite sex. You're always careful to point out that there's seriatim
oh.
as opposed to overlapping.
Oh, okay.
It's like serial monogamy.
You know what the perfect thing
okay,
is?
Yeah. That.
Because that it would be Latin, for those who don't know, which, of course, according to Dan Quayle, is what they speak in Latin America. And it's a perfect segue to our second topic with you, which is one of our favorite
right.
topics, which just happens to be a human. That, of course, would be Pope Francis. So he gives this interview to an Italian daily yesterday. But that isn't – were you fixed on what he said there about potentially embracing same-sex civil unions? Or were you obsessed or captured by the Fan magazine that has come out that essentially is devoted to Pope Francis that upsets him a little bit? What
well, yeah,
got
no,
you?
I realize that it's confusing because there's two Pope memes clashing out there at one time. But I was amused, certainly, by the idea that there is an Italian fan magazine, what's called Il Mio Papa, my Pope.
Yeah.
It has a centerfold, which I think
yeah, it's
is
great.
That offers, yeah, we'll want to get in the second issue to see what the nuns, the sisters of
okay,
poor Claire.
Fine.
Okay, I'm sorry. Just asking.
69 pages, by the way, the first edition.
Yeah. So that obviously caught my interest. But then, yes, of course, I mean, in a sense, much more significantly and addressed in today's Boston Globe by John Allen, the Father Guido Sarducci of the Boston Globe, our number one Vatican.
That was Alex Beam who said that. Go ahead.
Oh, what? Like someone else is saying.
Go ahead.
I mean, he gave this important interview. And again, people are reacting very, very powerfully. I mean, you were, in a sense, polite enough to bury the headline, but the headline has been, of course, that he seems to say, we're not going to put on sackcloth and ashes over the child sex abuse scandals in North America and elsewhere. And people are
very upset.
Very upset.
Yeah, the bishopsaccountability.org, which is a great website that's tracked all these scandals in the Catholic Church, they reacted very, very badly to this. The SNAP, the Survivors Network, has reacted very badly to this. He doesn't seem to be and if he doesn't grasp that they have not been transparent and they have not done everything they should have, this is going to be a huge stain on this papacy, no matter how many things he does about divorce and remarriage and other things. I think it's going to be tough.
Let's just read his words, obviously the translation. Here it is. This is from Pope Francis himself, which really is, at least in my estimation, a turnaround. Well, not a turnaround, but the first wrong turn that this guy has made in his year plus there. The Catholic Church is perhaps the only public institution to have acted with transparency and responsibility. No, this is about the sex abuse crisis. No one else has done more, yet the Church is the only one to have been attacked. Boy, that is, it's not just saying we'll get to it eventually.
Okay. Let me say a couple. I'm perfectly willing to be an apologist for unspeakable acts. I mean, first of all, let's tip our cap to Jim Carroll, whose massive New Yorker piece really called this one point out. I think really the best English language piece still on Pope Francis appeared about a month ago.
It's terrific.
James Carroll's long profile, he carved out a huge section of that profile saying, this is, going to be challenging, meaning he was very skeptical and he gave broad voice to the critics on this one point. And he called this out as a potential sort of soft spot for Francis. We're sitting in Boston. I know you don't want to hear this, but we're sitting in Boston. We're sitting in ground zero of this horror.
The whole world is ground zero. Maybe this was the first ground zero, but the world became ground zero. But continue, Alex.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
I mean, you could.
But go ahead.
I don't want to disagree with you. Ireland, North America. I don't want to disagree with you because I don't like playing a losing hand. And it's a terror. I'm sure that translation is accurate. And his use of the word transparency, I think to all three of us, seems like a very unfortunate choice of words.
Yes, inaccurate, I would say.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, having said that, alas, this is probably the way it looks from where he sits. And, I entertain hopes that, that he'll get out more and that we'll, that there will be evolutionary change on this.
Well, there is one hope that Sean O'Malley, the Archbishop of Boston, and many of the survivors are not keen on Sean O'Malley all the time either, because they claim he has not released sufficient numbers of names of accused, validly accused priests. But O'Malley is on this committee. He's very close to the Pope. I'm hoping that maybe O'Malley can convince him that more needs to be done, that maybe he doesn't have the perspective he should.
We spoke to a lot of – we've done a lot of interviews since Pope Francis took over. And I would say almost without exception, the interviews we've done in the last 3 or 4 months, even people who are the strongest advocates on this issue say, well, I wish he'd say more. The guy's been there a year. He's done a lot of first steps on a lot of things. We wish he'd acted more quickly or spoken more quickly and powerfully on this issue, but we're willing to give him a little more time. I think Brian McGorry is one of the people who said it. Your boss, actually, so be careful. A couple of weeks ago to us.
I answer to no man for the record.
It's one thing to be saying, give him time to get his act together, but to make an affirmative statement like this that is so not only blatantly wrong, but also is so offensive to so many people who suffered and so many people who care about the suffering, that's what's troubling. If he said, listen, I'm buried, I'm going to deal with this. Maybe I haven't dealt with this as fast as other people, but I'm the boss. I will deal with it when I think it's appropriate. I think most people would say, give him a few more months, give him something. This is really intense.
Yeah,
and
No, you're definitely right. I mean, Alan had an interesting piece in the Globe, He pointed this Australian, kind of the super conservative Australian head of the Treasury, to maybe get him out from the center on this. I mean, he's playing a very complicated chess game. I'm only throwing this out since I'm not Catholic. In the Episcopal religion, there's a huge balancing act played against Africa, which dominates the church. I mean, I feel bad. I apologize for this line of apologetics. I mean, it's quite possible that he's playing a global game. He has other audiences that he's he's conscious of at this time. And I hope, I mean, I hope for motion on this issue.
But let's not be totally depressed about the Pope's interview, because he did say something that has intrigued very many people, opening the possibility that he's not opposed in certain circumstances to civil unions. This is pretty dramatic
stuff. For same-sex couples.
Yes, for same-sex couples, exactly.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, what does that mean? I mean, in certain circumstances.
Well, it means that we're no longer talking about homosexual acts as intrinsic evils, like the last pope.
Well,
did.
To be fair, that was literally the first thing out of his mouth, right? I mean, who am I to judge these people?
Yes,
I mean,
or the guy you and Kevin Cullen quoted, the guy who is boycotting the St.
Patrick's Day parade
from that immaculate whatever.
Who talked about this too? So I think this is a wonderful thing, because he's obviously saying, you know, let's not be judgmental, let's be welcoming, let's understand that if you're in a same-sex union, you may have reasons. For economic reasons or for health reasons or health insurance reasons that these unions can go forward. So he seemed to give an okay to the possibility of those being ratified in the law.
He's a complicated guy. You know, I had this totally ridiculous random thought driving in here. I was thinking, like, if Pope Francis's first declaration can be, let's put some of these thorny, divisive social agenda items behind us, and he's obviously ridden a nice wave for roughly a year. Why can't the Republican Party do the same thing? I'd like to see a revivified Republican Party in America. I mean, why don't they take a cue from him? Okay, that's
okay,
enough.
Okay, fine. Yeah. One last thing, because this actually relates to you, even though you may not understand it. The headline is a new, and I mean, you may not understand the relationship. I don't mean you don't understand
it. Will you
speak
slowly, please?
New SAT really aims to realign with schoolwork. Here are the major changes happening in the SAT, in part because far fewer schools are using it. It's becoming less popular. One, they're going to end the longstanding penalty for guessing wrong. That is a good thing, I think. They're cutting obscure vocabulary words. I'm sort of ambivalent about that.
You're
that means you'll never understand an
that.
Alex Beam column.
Right.
But finally, making the essay optional. Essay was added, I don't know, a decade or so ago. If I were the decision maker, I would say dump the standardized multiple choice stuff. And even though I know that a lot of kids have essays written for them and they pay for them, the essay, you learn much more about a kid than how he or she does on a multiple choice exam, don't you?
And you're taking it during the tests, so you'd have to, I mean, you don't
unless you memorize it, theoretically you have to do it there. What's your take on this? I mean, because writing is what you theoretically do.
Well, it's what we all do, right? I mean, that's an interesting take, Jim, frankly. I mean, my wife hires writers, and I challenge her. I say, you know, I mean, so few people, like, make writers write, like, as a test, you know, because the secret is that really no one in America can write, like, three paragraphs to save their lives.
Agreed, which is arguably speaking and writing. Are there anything more important skills than those?
I agree with you. It'd be interesting to see if your idea is adopted. The point is, of course, that A and B, meaning language, so-called language skills and math, you know, there's got to be, I guess, a reward for the boys and girls who paid attention in class, right? I like the way you think, but
thank
I
you.
Mean, those are probably here to stay because the A students want to have their day in court.
Well, I think it's great in the sense that what they found is that the SATs are not necessarily an indicator of how you're going to do in college, that the kids that really did pay attention in class and did do their homework go on to college to do the same sort of thing. So why not reward them? And there is more standardization now with all these testings of schools. It's not like it was 20 or 30 years ago where you'd be in some terrible high school knowing nothing.
Well,
so
I think Jim alluded to this, but as is generally, which is really interesting, is that like the top 50 colleges have a lot of them have evolved not only the Common App, but there's like 20 colleges in this area that have one specific kind of, they're pooling their resources to kind of change the game. Which is great, because so kids can apply to the college they want to apply to, blah, blah, blah.
Now, let me be clear before you go, Alex, since time is on the wane here.
Are you going to murder
this
another song?
This was the point in which I was going to make clear that when I said to Judy Collins yesterday in my excitement, I love the way you do All My Life by the Beatles, it was actually In My Life. And it is one of the finest songs.
You made that mistake earlier today.
That's what I would have done. No, I did. It was recorded yesterday.
It's
and
rare.
Replayed today.
It's
but
rare,
I would have done
that. He makes a mistake.
So despite that, thank you for the correction.
He's
Alex
no.
Beam.
Where's my eco bag?
You find him in the Boston Globe. It's
right.
Beautiful to see you as
have
always,
a nice
Alex.
Day.
Thank you
okay.
so much. And we are joined this moment yet again by our colleague, Kim Saltmarsh, to make a final pitch for you contributing to the work we and everybody else in this building do. Take it away, Kim.
Well, that's what it's really about, Jim. You know, every once in a while, I feel truly inspired. And I am truly inspired in this moment right now. I have to tell you that not only did we go through all of the Judy Collins tickets, but so many people have gotten involved, left a comment online at WGBHnews.org as to why they feel that this is worthy of their support. And this is one of those moments. I hope in the next 3 minutes or so that you'll be a part of this, that you'll join this mission to say thank you to as many people as possible. You know, WGBH was founded on the idea that this community deserves to be connected, deserves to be informed, deserves to be inspired. That is still the mission today. I hope if you feel that is worthy of your support, that you'll step up right now in the next 2 minutes or so, since Boston Public Radio ends at 2 o'clock.
Okay, I'm going to read a couple of quick thank yous. Then you got to give a phone number and an email address. Fran and James, Rhode Island, Krista in Boston, Scott in Natick, Emma in West Newton, Kim in Millis, Noreen in Needham, Charlene in Natick, this is so great, Chris in North Weymouth, Robert in Wakefield, Rhode Island, and Daria in Arlington. Thank you all. The phone number is what, Kim?
It is 888-897-9424. You can always do your part online at WGBHnews.org. Again, that number, 888-897-WGBH, and thank you so much for your support. Bye.